Okay, this session, our last plenary session, we're going to discuss how enterprises can leverage risk management to shape their strategy. We're looking at this from the perspective of the board. Each panellist will present for around 20 minutes, and we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end. So please send your questions through on the SMS number, which you know, and we'll have up... That's it there. That's the SMS number. So if you send it through to that, it'll come over here and I'll get them up here. So we've got two speakers and I'll introduce both of them now, and then they'll just move one from the other as they go. So Greg DeVille, who's closest to me, is an educator, journalist and marketer with over 25 years of compliance, governance and risk management experience. Greg's trained at the AICD. They have a very effective, and if it's a... the Council of the Actuaries now send all their presidents on this course to sort of build governance expertise, and it's a fantastic course, and Greg's one of the presenters at the course. He delivers training, audit and consultancy services to board members, executives and their direct reports through his Melbourne-based company CRG Essentials. He's advised numerous companies and government business enterprises on governance strategy and risk issues. Our second speaker is Dick Morath. Dick's had a long career originally with Lendlease, but he's basically on all of the financial planning and superannuation trustee boards within the NAB MLC group. So would you please welcome our two speakers, and in particular Greg, as he comes up. Thank you.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I have the dubious honour of telling you that I am not an actuary. Got some fans, that's good. I'm a risk consultant who... I've been in business for 15 years, and about 10 years ago I decided I'd step away from overly regulated markets like financials. Did I say overly regulated? What I meant was highly regulated and well-regulated markets like financial services. And instead I spend most of my time in retail manufacturing, import-export, doing that kind of advisory work. It follows that I'm a perfect choice for a financial services forum from actuaries, doesn't it? Well, I think the reason I'm here is what you've heard already. They've done a lot of work with boards. I work with the Institute of Company Directors, as you've heard. I've done that for over a decade, and that means I've spoken to literally thousands of company directors in different settings about risk. I also advise boards and sit on boards. Those boards don't tend to be financial services boards, so again, if this stuff that I'm about to share with you comes from a different perspective than you're used to, perhaps that's why I'm here. Let's start by going right back to basics and looking at some definitions of risk. And the three that you see there, you can read them for yourselves, come from three different sources. The first is the International Standard on Risk Management, largely derived from its predecessor, the Australian Standard. The second is the definition provided in the Enterprise Risk Management Framework published by the Committee of Sponsoring Organisations of the Treadway Commission, or COSO. I love to spit that out. I love the way the Americans devise these things. But anyway, COSO is a private foundation that publishes these various authoritative documents, in this case an ERM framework. The third comes from the Investor Dictionary. And now that you've had a good look at them, you can probably see that they're all quite different from one another. The first focuses on both upside and downside. It speaks only of uncertainty. It talks of the effect of uncertainty on objectives, and this could be any kind of uncertainty, any form of risk, any risk type, and that's your international standard. The COSO definition, by contrast, continues to use the word adversely. So it's all about threats. And this tells you a little something about the culture of regulation in countries that adopt, or the country that adopts that as its Bible. And the third is the Investor Dictionary. It's all about downsides too, but it's only about financial downsides. You'll note that the COSO framework covers all risk types. Now, I went to a few sessions here today with the purpose of absorbing some... getting a sense of how you folks felt about risk and enterprise risk management. And I suspect that most of you, your immediate reaction might be to pick that third definition, to focus on financial issues and to be thinking mostly about threats. In some sessions I attended today, yes, the words opportunity word opportunity was advanced a couple of times, but I'm not sure that everybody's got their head around that in this space. And it's important to understand that from a board's perspective, while financial risk is significant, and indeed in the for-profit enterprise it is the key definer of value, most boards have a different issue on their minds when they think about risk. What do you reckon it is? Reputation, most of the time. Now, it could be that financial losses will have a reputational consequence. Don't get me wrong here. But the point is that if we adopt a straitjacketed focus on finance, and then we are likely to miss a large part of what boards are concerned with. And if we focus entirely on threats, then we're missing at least 50% of what risk is really about, according to the international standard. Let's not forget, however, that when focusing on threats, we will generally find some opportunities as well. Think how many businesses exist today that didn't 4 or 5 years ago because of the global threat known as climate change. Yeah? All of those contained opportunities as well. So, if we were to drill down into the COSO framework, we find that despite that negatively focused, adverse-style definition, part of the board's role under the COSO ERM framework is seizing opportunities. So they're on track. They know what they're on about. All us risk practitioners are speaking somewhat the same language, and it's about seizing opportunities, dealing with threats, and most of all, it's about aligning risk appetite and strategy. Let me just focus on that first point. The idea, the goal, the ideal these days for many boards whose thinking is advanced in this area is convergence. Convergence of their governance, risk, and compliance activities with their business strategies. So in many ways, the title of this session is a little problematic. It talks about leveraging enterprise risk management to shape strategy, whereas in an ideal world, they would be indistinguishable. Risk and strategy are inextricably linked. This is one of the core findings of the HIH Royal Commission. So if you're able to leverage, in one sense, you're getting it wrong, if you follow. But I think what the optimistic view of this that title, Leveraging Enterprise Risk Management, is an investment in risk is also an investment in strategy. If you do it correctly, it will improve strategic decision-making and bring about greater value for shareholders and stakeholders in enterprises. I'm going to stick with that anyway. On the convergence front, KPMG did a survey, the results of which were published in February 2012. Of the respondents, only 7% of US organisations and 9% globally said that their GRC activities were fully integrated into their business strategies, which leaves an awful lot of upside, doesn't it? If there is some benefit to be gained from this, then over 90% of companies in that survey group would be able to improve their performance. In my own experience consulting to boards, the no-brainer for a risk consultant like me is to take two documents. One, the risk inventory, risk matrix, call it what you will, this spreadsheet-style document that elaborates all the risks that might be confronting our business, and the strategic plan, and to look to see if there's any kind of correlation between the two. In far too many enterprises, there isn't. The risk framework is a laundry list of the usual suspects, staff fraud, catastrophe of some kind, nothing to do with the major strategic initiative that the board signed off on 5 minutes ago. And the problem with that is that that can lead to some personal downside for the directors involved, in that there is documentary evidence that they never properly engaged with risk at any time in their board tenure. Here's a device you all would have seen. It's the heat map. This is a typical mode of reporting to boards about the risk scenarios that are facing us and what our priorities should be. You get this sort of heat map or dashboard reporting by taking two numbers. Yeah, okay, you're actuaries. I'm going to talk about numbers. I'm probably going to talk badly about numbers. I don't get it like you do, but I'm going to talk about them. Two numbers, one representing likelihood or probability, one representing consequence or impact. Multiply the two together or add them in some cases, you get a risk rating. And in this respect, you prioritise what your risks are so that the board and senior management will attend to those in the red zone over there and can relax a bit about those in the green zone. That's all very nice. Sounds very rational. Can I quote someone I heard speaking earlier today? There was a principle, a very sound one. I'm not arguing with it. It's a sentence, goes like this. If you don't measure it, how can you manage it? I think the answer you're supposed to come to in your mind is that you can't. Truth of the matter is, that's not quite the right answer. If you don't measure something, how do you manage it? Well, you manage it differently. And in many occasions, you will therefore manage it less well than if you are able to measure it. Let me give you an example. It's not often I get to do this. I went and saw a stand-up comedian the other day, and his presentation, Dave Gorman's his name, his presentation was entirely apposite to today, so I'm going to pinch his stuff. All right? Have you ever seen an ad for wristwatches? And have you noticed that the time on the wristwatch is always 10:08? Yeah? Or 1:52? Ever wondered why that is? Well, there's two theories. It goes back to the analog days. Wristwatches, of course, is what they are. 10:08 and 1:52 both look like this, yeah? And that's the time that most looks like a smiling face. And therefore will make people feel good about their watch purchase. The alternate explanation is it's the best way to frame the brand of the manufacturer. Yeah, maybe. Marketing palaver, whichever is true, it makes sense. Explain to me, though, having moved to digital watches, and some of you know where I'm going with this, and digital phones, the time that is represented on any HTC phone marketing, it's always 10:08. When it's two numbers, the smile thing doesn't work and the brand thing doesn't work, so why are they doing this? Because they can't think of anything better to do. It's received wisdom. There doesn't seem to be any harm in doing it, and that's a perfectly valid way to make decisions when they're such trivial decisions, right? So, yeah, we can make decisions without measurement, but you can be overtaken by events. They can be bad decisions. You could say the same thing about recruitment of baseballers. When somebody comes along and does some real measurement, as they did in Moneyball, then that can be a different way of making decisions and a better one. My point being, though, we don't necessarily have the capacity to measure everything. And if we say to ourselves, we're only going to manage the things that we can measure, by golly, I tell you, that's a philosophy that really strongly appeals to white males of a certain age, the folks who dominate boards. It's a self-reinforcing philosophy. And so therefore what happens is that senior managers and boards focus only on those things that can be measured. And the problem with that is, or two problems with that, might be that these aren't, in fact, the major drivers of business success. Secondly, that the measurements may be poor, they may be flawed. Somebody may have come up with this measurement in order to get it in front of these guys to make them, but they're poor. They're based on some survey, some pointless, flawed survey. And I might add, as a sidebar here, I've heard some people talking about staff surveys today, and they're professionals, and I'm not arguing at all against those approaches. But many of you may have seen something called SurveyMonkey. It's not difficult for the less than gifted amateur to download a survey template, knock out a survey in order to come up with some findings which they can present to senior management or a board to add some pseudoscience to what is in fact a gut feeling. Which takes me to this quote. The real problem with this world of ours is not that it's unreasonable or even that it is reasonable. The problem is that it is nearly reasonable. You can get a false comfort from numbers, a false and inappropriate comfort that may put a board in a position of, as I say, too much comfort. They're more comfortable than they should be because they've seen a graph. Let's remember how these heat maps were generated. A bunch of people came up with some entirely arbitrary and subjective judgments. We collectivized and manipulated these judgments in order to prioritize some things. You, of all people, know that there is no voodoo power to this. Yeah? And it's important to remind boards of that from time to time. The other point of these exercises is, in fact, to be able in the future, should a strategy go wrong or a risk materialise, to be able to say at the coroner's inquiry, the Royal Commission or whatever, that you did your best, right? If you're a director. And that sounds cynical, but it's kind of true. In preparing for today, I scanned the papers to try and find an example of what I was talking about, and here's an example. You probably can't see it at the back, but it's a story about NAB making a change in its strategy to reduce its exposure to risk in the United Kingdom market. I'm explaining this poorly, but the bottom line is it's about a decision made in 2004 to sell some of its UK assets, but not all of them. Now, I would bet you that thanks to the efforts of professionals like yourselves, that decision in 2004 can be justified. And I'm not criticising it either. You know, looking at the price you would have got for those businesses at the time, looking at multiple economic scenarios going forward, I'll bet that that decision can be justified, even though now it's time to change tack. I'll bet the same thing can't be said of BP. And I'm not talking about its decision to drill for oil in the Gulf, in what is now known as deep water, the deep water rig. And I'm not talking about the way it invests in mitigating risks of that rig. I'm talking about its strategic decision not to engage with social media, thereby allowing, for those who followed the case, about 4 weeks where the Twitterverse was rampant with stories, some true, some false, about how BP was managing this disaster and the incalculable damage to its reputation that happened as a result of that decision. We need some better metrics around those things. We've got some pretty good metrics around these things. You can help. Okay, so this is a model of an enterprise risk management framework. The purpose of these frameworks is to ensure that matters that require it are brought to the attention of the board and senior management so that the articulated risk appetite of the enterprise can be brought to bear on decision making. An effective framework would force boards to focus on the key drivers, not just those that are easily measurable, and this is the important thing, would drive investments in better measurement techniques for the things that you guys currently call qualitative. So some qualitative quantification challenges I want to throw at you just to wrap up my time. The first is the measurement of impact in terms of reputational and branding dimensions. I think I've already addressed that. The second, I'm happy to say that I knew I was going to be doing this session a few weeks ago, so I've actually posed this question to 6 different AICD groups of directors. I've said to them, would you value a measure for human capital depreciation? That is to say, a thoroughly researched mathematical model that shows how we degenerate as humans in our decision making in the course of age or occupancy of a position. Would you value this kind of hard data? Without exception, they said yes. I'm not much of a surveyor either. Obviously, I loaded the question. My next question was, what would you do with it? Well, they said 2 things. We would be able to plan our training better, so you could see your training investment as system maintenance for the human capital. We'd be able to make better investment decisions around training, and we'd be able to do succession planning that went beyond just having a list of people who might succeed the chief executive, but have a rotational policy so that we got the most out of our human capital. That's 2 things we could do if there was a measurement of that currently intangible factor, which is so critical to so many enterprises. So there you are, get to work on that. Lastly, institutionalised deception and the shooting of messengers. What do I mean by that? That heat map model is all very well. In some companies, it is very much part of the risk culture that if a manager allows a risk that he or she owns to move into the red zone, then he or she can expect a much shorter career than they had before. Right? So that institutionalises the falsehood around the reporting of either the likelihood or impact of a potential risk scenario. You guys can help with that because you've got some credibility that most of these managers don't have in reporting these figures. The other form of institutionalised deception is the word risk appetite, and I'll come back to that later if there's interest in that topic. I want to close with these 2 examples, though. In my training business, we have lots of war stories that are clearly about things that have gone wrong. The 2 I'm showing you are still jury's out type issues. Cotton On is an Australian company that's based in Geelong. It's quite a success story. It has a global reach now. It sells in LA, Malaysia, you name it, and it sources its products from all over the world. It is committed to fair trade and avoiding child labour, things like that, and its Cotton On Foundation is an instrument of all of those good things. Unfortunately, on 2 occasions in the past couple of years, it's been taken to task by the ACCC for dangerous products, specifically flammable nightwear. Now, is this going to impact on its global retail penetration or not? We don't know that yet. But what we do know is that in a quest to grow quicker and quicker, it failed to attend to those simple manufacturing must-dos for the domestic market. What will be the consequences? We'll see. The other example, Groupon chose speed over integration, decided to get its business into multiple markets as quickly as possible to support an IPO. Well, unfortunately, the idea of a daily deal has been captured by a whole range of other companies in a whole range of markets. They didn't bother to protect their turf. Good thing, bad thing, depends on your perspective. If you're going to make money out of the IPO, probably speed was a critical factor. If you're going to invest in the IPO, maybe you would have preferred that they attended to the more sustainable or potentially sustainable aspects of the business. I'm going to close with that. I've stayed mostly away from financial services. For that, I apologise, but I know my next speaker will rectify that. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. I am an actuary by background, but of more significance, I'm the last speaker and I'm the one who's between you and a drink or the bus. Now, that's a bit of a challenge. Greg's talked about the principles. I'm just going to tell you three stories, but they're real stories and it's really about risk management. And the thesis, what I'm going to be trying to get over is that it actually is common sense, and I think it's about simple questions and getting clear answers. I had hoped to do this by actually asking you questions. I didn't realise there'd be so many of you, and I don't think the microphone, so that won't work. But I'm still going to pose questions, and if you've got a quick answer, don't mind shouting it out, because that makes it interactive. I just want to set the scene. So the first one's about advice. I chair all the advice boards in the MLC NAB group. So just, again, to set the scene, we've got employed planners. They'd be in National Australia Financial Planning. We've got self-employed planners. Garvin, Godfrey Pembroke, Apogee, Meriton, MLC Financial Planning. We've got practice development managers who have a panel of about 40 of those advisors in all those jurisdictions. And we've got state managers of all those dealerships. And we've got heads of those dealerships. So we have a compliance committee, which I chair, which is its duty is that our advisors give good advice, put it in a nutshell. We've got three external directors, myself, Ian Crowe, a past chief executive of MLC, and David Bleakley, who's a name that many of you who would know financial planning would know. And the other people on that board, on that committee, are the heads of the dealerships, and that's important. So, what's the risk that we're worried about? What's the key risk that we're worried about?
Reputation.
Reputation, yes, I agree with what Greg said. Reputation, and how would our reputation be damaged?
Bad advice,
absolutely. So, the risk, the key risk is bad advice. So what's the key risk mitigant that we have utilised to protect us against that risk? Any thoughts?
Training.
Training, yep, important. Avoid conflicts, yeah, that's important too. So no bias in the remuneration, yep.
Quality people.
All correct. And there's another one I thought someone might give to me, which is obviously have an audit team, which is to go...
Structured process,
yep. That's important too. But the most important thing is actually, again, it's something Greg mentioned. We haven't tic-tacked, so I like this. The most important is culture. Setting the cultural framework. So how do we do that? And this is where I say that I think it does get down to common sense. So every board meeting, we have two of those practice development managers or state managers picked off at random and they come in, they front. No paper, no written paper. They're just coming in cold and they're going to tell us how they supervise their advisors, what their values are, what their beliefs are, what issues they have, etc., etc. And we ask them questions. And think of who's asking the questions. So the external directors are asking the questions, but so are the heads of the dealership. We're all together in this. So management and board are aligned. And we ask questions. And I can remember three particular individuals where the answers weren't comforting. and that was pretty evident. So the board asked that they come back again in 3 months' time and take us through how they'd implemented the feedback that they got that day. Now, I'm delighted to be able to say one of them we never saw again. Management made the call, not the board. We didn't need to because the culture was right. Management saw this guy will never get there. So we didn't see him again. The other two came back and I was absolutely delighted. They've become leaders in real risk management in financial planning. So it's a good story because what was the most important thing of all? The culture. Everyone knowing do the right thing and it's expected that you will do the right thing. A subsidiary element of that is whenever advisors have to have their letter of authority terminated. Again, that's not something that we do as the board. We don't need to. We get told about, but management talk through the issues with us and then they tell us what they're going to do about it. And I can't think of an occasion where, in effect, we have got the capacity to override their decision, but we have backed their decision in every case because the culture is right. So that's the first example in regard to what I think is just common sense in risk management. The second example now, if I jump to the superannuation trustee world, we have three big super funds in the whole MLC world, but we have one set of directors, three entities, but one set of directors. Now, the reason we do that, it's very efficient, it's very consistent, and we've got a good group of people and we want to use them effectively. But not that long ago, we had a successor fund transfer where we were looking to transfer from one members from one super fund to another of that three. So what was the key risk that obviously would come to the fore in considering that issue? Sorry? Conflict of interest, absolutely. It isn't difficult, is it? You just got to think about the question and what is the risk? So, absolutely, conflict of interest. So what did we do? Any suggestions? Sorry? Separate the two boards. Absolutely. Half of us were in one fund and half of us, the transferring trustee, and the other half were the receiving trustee. Simple stuff. Simple stuff. But you've got to ask the questions at the outset. Last example I wanted to give is actually combining the two, advice and superannuation. Hope I don't get into hot water here. And it's really about member investment choice, but just a preliminary one first. It also relates to a bit to risk appetite. So in regard to pensions, we aren't obligated to have a default fund. In regard to accumulation phase, yes, we have to have a default fund, but we don't have to have one in pensions. But we thought we'd like to have one. But then we thought about risk appetite and what risk appetite we wanted to take, and we came to the decision that, no, we're not going to have a default in pensions because we want the member to make the choice, to make the decision. It's too important a decision, and obviously we strongly recommended that they get advice. So our risk appetite wasn't that we wanted to make that decision for members. But then if I go on to take it a step further, and this is going back a bit, but in 2006, APRA put out a draft guidance circular on managing investments. This is in the member investment choice world. And the suggestion was in the guidance circular, the draft, that if you've got someone who's made an investment choice, you as trustee should be thinking hard about rebalancing that member's investment as markets move and change over time. And we thought a lot about that, and we thought that that was way, way outside our risk appetite. And so we argued with APRA about that. And the reason we took that point of view was that if we did do that, rebalance a member's investment, we don't know the investment, we don't know the member's details, we just know what the account that they've got with us, that's all we know. We don't know if they've got an advisor or whatever. So if we rebalance that member's account without that member's consent, if I was the member, I'd do nothing. If it worked, if they prospered as a result of it, I'd say, well, trustee, you're just doing your job. And if it didn't work, I'd sue the pants off you and I'd win every time. Now, that was an interesting discussion that we had with APRA. And I'm pleased to say that APRA got it in the end. And that element went out of the guideline. But it was an interesting discussion because what it showed to me was that there was, at that time, no link between the worlds of advice, FSRA, corporations law and the like, and the worlds of superannuation, SIS. Because when we had this discussion with APRA, I can remember them saying to me, we're talking about advice and all that. I said, show me where it mentions advice in SIS. It doesn't. Now, what's interesting is now the two are coming together. With Stronger Super and with FOFA, we are obviously having advice and superannuation links. But those same questions in regard to risk management are going to be very relevant now, just as they were back in 2006. And I'm sure we'll work our way through them because they're simple questions, clear answers. And the conflict one in regard to the two boards is the best example. So thank you for being such a good audience. Thanks for giving me some of the answers as well. And now I'll hand back to Barry.
Thank you.